From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Word was spreading around Ramallah and elsewhere that the Israelis were possibly going to stage a commando raid on the compound, and the fear was that there could be a gun battle, maybe the Palestinians firing first if they knew the Israelis were coming in, and potentially a bloodbath. And so we wanted to do what we could to at least maybe stall the operation.
A new group of international activists get past Israeli soldiers into Yasser Arafat's compound. Ariel Sharon proposes to annex half of the West Bank. Today we'll have a debate on the roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Israeli activists mount a campaign against Microsoft, which posts billboards around Tel Aviv saying, "From the depth of our heart, thanks to the Israeli Defense Forces." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has named a team which will investigate Israel's destruction of the Jenin refugee camp. A former Finnish president will lead the team. It also includes a former UN High Commissioner for Refugees and a former head of the International Red Cross. Smoke, gunfire, and the thud of sound grenades engulfed the area around the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem yesterday, only hours before the outbreak of gunfire. 17 journalists had their Israeli government press credentials seized by an Israeli army officer in the area. Israeli helicopter fired missiles at a car in Hebron, killing a local commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and his bodyguard. Crowds took to the streets of Hebron calling for revenge after the men's charred bodies were pulled from the burning wreckage. Meanwhile, the head of Palestinian Preventive Security, Jibril Rajoub, said outside his destroyed headquarters today, quote, "I don't think it's possible for us after this sea of blood to talk about security coordination or any kind of coordination with Israel. It's over," he said, adding, "Israel will never have security in the occupied territories." The Washington Post reports that Rajoub's comments are significant because Rajoub's job has been to cooperate with the CIA and Israel's Internal Security Service to prevent Palestinian groups from sending suicide bombers to attack. Zacharias Moussaoui electrified a courtroom in Washington yesterday when he took over what was scheduled to be a routine hearing, publicly firing his lawyers and praying for the destruction of the United States and Israel. The 33-year-old French citizen was being held in jail on September 11th on immigration charges, but authorities accuse him of being part of the hijacking conspiracy and faces the death penalty. Moussaoui raised his hand at the start of the hearing, launched into a lengthy speech. He said the U.S. government and the court-appointed attorneys conspiring to kill him. He also said his current legal team was only interested in, quote, greed, fame, and vanity, and asked for a Muslim lawyer. In the meantime, Moussaoui wants to defend himself. The judge ruled he's entitled to do so if he passes a mental exam. Moussaoui is being kept for 22 hours a day in a tiny cell with access to radio, television, music, or other prisoners. Britain has turned down requests from judges in Spain and France to question former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger about the Condor Plan, under which Latin America's military regimes agreed jointly to eradicate their opponents in the late 1970s. The decision signals Britain is siding with the U.S. government, who says all the judges' questions should be directed to the U.S. State Department. Three more people have been killed in the western Indian state of Gujarat. In the last 2 days, close to 30 people have been killed, according to police. 10 people died on Sunday alone when police opened fire on a crowd. Pope John Paul II told U.S. cardinals he's deeply grieved over the pedophile crisis affecting the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope addressed the cardinals during the first session of a two-day meeting to discuss the crisis. He said the church must be confident that, quote, this time of trial will bring a purification of the entire Catholic community. He also said the, quote, immense spiritual and social good of a vast majority of priests in the U.S. should not be forgotten. Americans are among the biggest donors to the Vatican, and some in the U.S. have expressed alarm that the scandal may lead to a boycott. The White House slashed nearly all the funds requested by the Energy Department for money to improve the security of nuclear weapons and waste. According to the New York Times, Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham sent a letter to the director of the Office of Management and Budget requesting close to $4 million to guard radioactive materials. The director passed on to Congress only 7% of that request. The U.S. has ousted the director of the global agency charged with ridding the world of chemical weapons, José Bustani, who was unanimously reelected last year as the director general of the 145-nation Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. But after he refused repeated U.S. demands to step down, the State Department dispatched envoys to a number of capitals and threatened to cut off funding to the organization. The U.S. is responsible for nearly a quarter of the agency's budget. With around half the member organizations abstaining, Bustani was voted out yesterday. And yesterday was Earth Day. To mark the occasion, former oil executive President Bush spent the day in the acid rain-plagued Adirondack Mountains to sell his Clear Skies initiative. The plan's market-based approach to reducing pollutants, environmental groups warn, the plan would be a step backward from goals set by the Clean Air Act regulations already on the books. But just days before the photo op, the Bush administration succeeded in ousting the head of the UN-sponsored Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Robert Watson. Watson's an outspoken critic of Bush's energy policy. Controversy has marred the meeting since it was revealed in the U.S. State Department was supporting Watson's ouster. That controversy turned to outrage when the Natural Resources Defense Council uncovered a memo from the U.S. oil corporation ExxonMobil asking the White House to unseat Watson. ExxonMobil was a major contributor to Bush's election campaign. We're joined on the phone by David Doniger. He's policy director at the Natural Resources Defense Council's Climate Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you.
Can you tell us about the memo that you uncovered?
The memo was sent in February of last year, right after the new administration came in, and it asked for the dismissal of Bob Watson, who's a well-recognized expert who runs with great skill this international science panel. They asked for his dismissal because they didn't like the results that the panel was coming up with, namely that climate change is really going on and global warming is caused by man-made emissions, fossil fuel emissions. Just over a year later, after more lobbying from fossil fuel interests, the administration decided to back the alternative candidate in an anybody-but-Watson approach, and they were successful last Friday in getting other countries to replace Watson.
Again, the memo from ExxonMobil.
Yes.
And how did you get a hold of it?
Well, under the Freedom of Information Act, we asked last year for documents that would explain who the Bush administration met with before changing its position on the Global Warming Treaty, and this is one of the things we got back. It's very similar to the influence peddling that's demonstrated regarding the Energy Task Force, where we got 11,000 pages of documents from the Energy Department that demonstrate that they met almost entirely with only one side, the energy industry, in deciding what the energy policies should be for the United States.
David Doniger, thanks for joining us, Policy Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Climate Center. You're listening to Democracy Now!
If you think of the Middle East in this modern time, you can't help but say the word Palestine. People there have lost their lands, some have lost their homes. They live in other countries, their freedom almost gone. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love, needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. There seems to be no answer that gives the reason why people cannot live, so no one has to die. Raise your hand for freedom. Raise your hand for truth. Raise your hand for justice. That's what we've got to do. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love, needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. People there are rich, people there are poor. Some has education, what are they fighting for? Fighting for their freedom, fighting for their land, fighting for their children. Let's help them make a plan. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love, needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love.
Singer, civil rights activist, and composer Matt Jones, a member of the Freedom Singers. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat met with U.S. State Department official William Burns on Monday to discuss the standoff there and at Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity. The U.S. envoy met Arafat at his compound, where about 300 aides, security guards, and foreigners have been confined to a few rooms by Israeli troops since late March. Israel's demanding the Palestinians hand over five suspects in October's assassination of the Israeli transportation minister, the Israeli tourism minister, as well as the alleged mastermind of a large arms shipment to the Palestinian Authority intercepted by Israel. Arafat has refused, saying the six will face trial in Palestinian courts. There's growing speculation that Israeli forces might try to break in and seize the wanted men. Even as they met, an Israeli bulldozer destroyed several cars parked outside and began building a rampart, this according to foreign activists in the compound. On Sunday, a group of about 30 international activists gathered at the hospital in Ramallah to plan a march to the presidential compound as word spread that a siege was imminent. By staging a series of diversions, the activists managed to get a group of six activists inside Yasser Arafat's compound. Kevin Skorzak is inside the compound, one of those who got in. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yeah, hi, Amy.
Can you tell us where you are exactly?
I'm in a room looking out the, I believe it's the east side of the compound, and about 30 feet away is some of the buildings in the rest of the compound that have been occupied by soldiers. I don't know the layout that just from moving around the few rooms we can move inside, and most of the windows are closed, so I kind of know the layout inside, but it's kind of hard to get a sense of what the entire complex looks like outside since we don't have access to it all.
Can you explain why you did go in this weekend?
Because of what you suggested, there was some anticipation that there was going to be some assaults by Sharon. There's a lot of there was some talk by some of the missions or the consular to the French and to other nationals here that they need to move now. There was some concern. And people interpreted this as that there might be an action coming. Powell and Burns and everyone has come, I mean, the discussions inside here with Arafat and the news that we get is that they're not very helpful, that they're a waste of time, and there's no proposals on the table that they're being offered. So, you know, it's really a standoff, and the Israelis aren't really offering any suggestions other than what you've said, that they need to turn these people over unconditionally.
Have you met with Yasser Arafat?
Yes, he's come and visited with us a couple of times and met him in the past, him in the hallway and so forth. And we passed the letter, myself and Rebecca, the two Americans here, to William Burns yesterday when he was here and sort of, you know, let them know that there was a couple of Americans here. Not that I don't know how much difference it makes, but a lot of the other internationals were concerned that we made our presence known as Americans.
Where are you from?
I'm from Brooklyn.
And why did you go to the occupied territories?
Well, I got here a month ago with many of the other OSM activists who came and spent time in Bethlehem, or Bethlehem area, and Mohaim Jenin and Beit Jala, the first incident where, you know, they fired and wounded some of the folks. And since then, I've been spending time and went up to Jenin camp for several days and got in there early on last week and saw some of that. It seemed an opportunity to do something effective. I mean, people do protests at home. People are, you know, organizing boycotts and hopefully student campaigns and disinvestment campaigns. But it seemed like an opportunity to use some of the, you know, the skills and, you know, experiences we have in doing protests and activist work here you know, hear in a direct way. So it sounded pretty exciting.
We're also joined on the phone by Georgina Reeves with the Independent Media Center of Palestine. She's in Bethlehem watching yesterday on television as sound grenades engulf the area around the besieged Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem on the eve of talks between the Israeli army and a team of Palestinian negotiators about the standoff, with hundreds of people still inside the church. Georgina Reeves, you've just come from a news conference. What happened there?
Yes, well, some of the Palestinian negotiators who were meeting today at the Peace Center in Manger Square with Israeli representatives came to the Bethlehem Hotel to give a brief press conference about what has happened. They stated that the negotiations, they didn't give a lot of information. They said that the negotiations were positive. They're meeting again tonight at 6 o'clock local time and to continue with the negotiations. And they seem hopeful that there will be some resolution by the end of tonight. But one of the things they stressed was there's absolutely no negotiation for the Palestinians inside who are accused of either terrorism or gunmen, whatever. They are not going to be exiled. They will not accept any form of deportation for any of the people inside the church. So we're actually waiting now for the next couple of hours to pass until they have the next meeting to see what comes from that.
And what has been the scene over the last 24 hours outside the Church of the Nativity as we watched these stun grenades on TV going off yesterday?
Well, it's been a pattern. That is a usual occurrence when it starts getting dark. There's different opinions as to how the severity of the attack. Some people have said that the Israelis were actually making a full assault against the church in an attempt to gain access, but were repelled. Obviously, I wasn't there, so I can't confirm that is accurate, but that has come from sources inside the church that we've been speaking to. But it's also a pattern of the kind of the breaking down the psychology and the mentality of the people inside by continuing with assaults, using sound grenades, shooting, etc., to try and encourage them to come out and to try and break the kind of morale of people inside.
We're also joined on the phone by Adam Keller. He's a spokesperson for Gush Shalom, which is an Israeli peace group. And he's dealing with a story that my colleague Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI brought to my attention about Microsoft. It declares on its website we're serious about making the world a better place. And one of the things that it has recently done is put up billboards around Tel Aviv that say, "From the depth of our heart, thanks to the Israeli Defense Forces." Adam Keller, can you talk about Gush Shalom's response?
Yes. I have to give a little bit of the context. In fact, this slogan is not only of Microsoft. It is there is a sort of a government-sponsored patriotic drive, you could say. The government is encouraging all kinds of institutions and business corporations to put up signs or stickers or advertisements with this slogan in various variations, and always with the same the Israeli national flag. And Microsoft, I suppose it was the Israeli Microsoft branch took it up, like other big corporations in Israel who are now jumping on the patriotic bandwagon, and they have put up these signs, and we felt that there is a discrepancy between the claims of Microsoft to be committed to globalization, however much we might not like the capitalist globalization, but still the concept of open borders, free flow of goods and thoughts and economics and so on is not very compatible with a very narrow-minded nationalism and militarism and support for the kind of thing which Sharon is doing at this moment against the Palestinians. So we sent an email to Bill Gates via various Microsoft addresses which we found on the internet, and pointed out this discrepancy to Bill Gates. I don't know if it got actually to him or to some officials of Microsoft. In fact, we never got any answer directly from Microsoft, not even a kind of polite statement like, we got your message and it is under consideration. Absolutely nothing. But the fact is that yesterday some of our people saw at least two of the signs have come down in the area, Tel Aviv area. We're not there anymore. It's a very enormous signs, kind of several meters long. They were just not there. And then late at night, we got a message which told us an interesting story that the Microsoft branch in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Emirates was under a very heavy attack in these countries, of course, for Microsoft supporting the Israeli army attacking the Palestinians. And these branches have passed on their complaint to the center of Microsoft, and there was a Microsoft representative who came to a technological exhibition in Riyadh, and there he said that these signs have come down and that it was a mistake, and that it is because the different branches of Microsoft in different countries have autonomy, but this should not have happened, and kind of very, very... it must have been very embarrassing for them.
So, why does it bother you so much?
Now, it bothers me. This whole patriotic campaign is very much bothering me. There is a kind of drummed up campaign to support what the army is doing against the Palestinians, hailing it as a big war against terrorism and so on. In fact, I think that it is very much modeled on what was in the United States in the immediate after mass of September 11, including the very much national flags, which you see everywhere. There happened to be, last week happened to be the Israeli Independence Day, but there were many more flags than usual on Independence Day in this country. And so we could not. We are not in a position to go, for example, to the Israeli cell phone company, which also put up this kind of big patriotic signs. We tell them, don't do it. Then they say, why not? We are for the army fighting terrorism. But we thought that when the Israeli Microsoft did it, we could find a weak spot by. Sort of coming between the Israeli branch and their international backers, the international center, and in this way at least getting rid of at least one ingredient of this patriotic campaign.
Finally, we just had our first guest, Kevin Svorjak, who is one of two Americans who just got into the Yasser Arafat compound. What do you think of this action of international solidarity movement activists going into the compound in Ramallah?
Yeah, I'm very much for it. Actually, I and several of my friends, some 15 of us altogether, we were in Ramallah yesterday morning, demonstrating in front of the same compound. We did not succeed to get in. I think that the army was a little bit more alert after this six Americans got in. I am really very full of admiration for their courage and determination. We were just got about 100 meters from the compound, and there we were stopped by quite a lot of soldiers with tanks and armored personnel carriers, and we were raising signs in English and Hebrew and Arabic saying down with the occupation, stop Sharon's war crimes, and also Arafat is our partner, and we had made the special signs that was only in Hebrew, soldiers go home, better refuse, military prison is better than occupation duty. You know that there are at this moment 39 Israeli reserve and conscript soldiers imprisoned for refusing to serve in the occupied territories. And we are going to have a big march and rally in Tel Aviv on the night of 27th. We hope for at least 5,000 and better for 10,000. And with this same slogan, a kind of coalition of peace movements, which was formed recently, is called the coalition, the Jewish-Arab coalition against the occupation.
Have you heard about the protests in the United States? First, the rally of nearly 100,000 for the Israeli state, and that was last week, and then this past weekend of also nearly 100,000 people who were rallying around a number of issues, including against what the Israeli military is doing in the occupied territories.
Yes, it was reported, of course, the I would not call it pro-Israel rally because I think it was against the true interests of Israel. I would say pro-Sharon rally was very much very extensively reported. Of course, they wanted and tried to make very much of it and present it as counterbalance for the very many anti-demonstrations which have been taking place all over the world. And also the other rally was mentioned in the news. There were also some pictures, but they were trying to claim that it was much smaller. They didn't say that it was of the same size, and also they tried to emphasize the present participation of Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, to say so. Of course, it is the Arabs are against us, and the Arabs in the United States are also against us. So, what is new about it? By the way, they do the same, by the way, in demonstrations here also. When there are demonstrations of Jews and Arabs together, they always try to emphasize the Arab participants and they emphasize the Jewish participants.
I want to thank you very much, Adam Keller, for joining us of Gush Shalom, speaking to us from Israel. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a discussion about the history of Israel and Zionism. We'll be back in a minute.
So what is the answer? Question of you, what do I look for? What shall I do? Which way do I turn when I'm feeling lost? If I sell my soul, now what will it cost? Must I become shall I remain upright or get down at all?
All the questions that I left would be answered
when I decide which road to choose.
What is it answer to
the question of
you? Question of you, Prince Graffiti Bridge, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres on Monday confirmed a report that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon wants to annex half the West Bank under an unpublished plan for the Palestinian territories that he's drawing up with close advisors. Following a report in the London Telegraph, Peres confirmed in an interview on Meet the Press that Sharon is suggesting Israel annex half the West Bank as an interim agreement. Peres says he doesn't think that it's a final solution. Meanwhile, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Sharon angrily declared Sunday at his weekly cabinet meeting that the Israeli government will not discuss the removal of any Israeli settlements on Palestinian land until the next elections in October 2003. Banging his hand on the table for emphasis, he said there would also be no such discussion after those elections if he is reelected. The subject was raised when a Labour Party minister asked why the government doesn't adopt Israeli army officer recommendations to evacuate isolated settlements. According to an Israeli news program, senior officers are arguing that isolated settlements in the Gaza Strip have become a tremendous security burden, requiring a regiment of soldiers to protect each one. Today on Democracy Now! We'll have a discussion on the history of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, looking at the expanding settlements on Palestinian lands, but also going back earlier to the 1967 and 1948 wars and the roots of the Zionist movement. We're joined on the telephone by Professor Ilan Pape, who is a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Haifa University and author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Pape.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Well, why don't we start off with this plan that has been laid out now. It was first in the British papers, and Shimon Peres, foreign minister, has come to the United States, says it is true that Sharon is suggesting Israel annex half the West Bank.
Yes, well, I think this plan sounds very authentic. Anybody who knows Ariel Sharon and knows his public appearances and what he used to write in the newspapers should not be surprised that this is the final map which he has in his mind with regards to a settlement of the Palestine question. In that kind of map, he sees most of the West Bank as part of Greater Israel and a very small part of it as an autonomous Palestinian entity, but not a proper sovereign state, although he only recently said he's willing to call that part a state. But I do think that he wants to transfer some of the people from the West Bank into the Gaza Strip, where he can cordon the people in a big, like prison. As you know, the Gaza Strip is encircled by a fence all around. And I think this really tallies with his previous plans and opinions on how to, as he calls it, to solve the Palestine question.
Let's go back in time to the founding of Israel. If you can give us a brief history of how Israel was established. A lot of what is happening now has prevented a more historical, analytic discussion of the roots of the crisis.
Right. Well, I think it's very good to go back, and it's important to go back to the 1948 war. We have to remember that that war was fought after 30 years of British rule in Palestine, and when the British had enough, they transferred the problem of Palestine to the United Nations. Now, the United Nations suggested the partitioning of Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. At the time, the Jews were 40% of the population, and the Arabs were 60% of the population. And yet the United Nations in its partition plan suggested that 60% of the land would go to the Jews, as I said, which were the minority, and that the majority of the country, 60% would go to the, the majority of the country would go to the minority, the Jews, and that the majority of the people, the Palestinians, would have only 40% of the country. And this may explain why, at the time, the Arab states and the Palestinian leadership rejected their partition plan. As a result, a war was waged between the sides. And at the end of the war, and I'm sorry to burden the listeners and the viewers with percentages, but I think it's important, at the end of the war, the State of Israel was founded on almost 80% of Palestine, and only 20% of Palestine remained in Arab hands, part in the hands of the Jordanians and part in the hands of the Egyptians. Now, out of the 1 million Palestinians who were supposed to be inside the Jewish state, three-quarter, 750,000, were more or less expelled in an ethnic cleansing operation, and this is how the Palestinian refugee problem came into being. So if we go back to the 48 war, if I can sort of summarize what I was saying, is that we have to remember that the war ended, on the one hand, with the creation of the State of Israel on a very large chunk of historical Palestine. And in the comparison, the Palestinians, as a result of the war, lost their homeland, the villages, the towns, and many, many of them became refugees as a result of a master plan to expel them during the war. So the war of 1948 is very much alive in the collective memories of both Israelis and Palestinians, and one cannot solve the problem without relating to that war.
Professor Pape, the story that you are telling now is not one that is generally put forward by those certainly who talk about the founding of Israel who are Jewish around the country. It's not the accepted history. Why do you think that is? You're a Jewish professor yourself.
I am. Indeed, this is not the version, the historical version or narrative which is taught in Israeli school or is accepted by the majority of the Israeli academics. I think that the kind of history or the official historical Israeli version was needed in order to allow the Israelis to continue to believe that they are living within a democracy and that they are morally superior to the Palestinian side. It was very important, I think, for the Israeli cultural and political systems to deny what really had happened in 1948, to repress the unpleasant chapters, because if they had accepted it, this would have opened the way for legitimizing the Palestinian demands, such as the right of return of the refugees, such as reparation and compensation for the expulsion, and in general would put the Palestinian in a much better position in the world, in the eyes of the world public opinion. So I think there were good reasons, so to speak, for not admitting what the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and the Israeli government had been doing. And surprisingly, there was not even a willingness to say what I say in my book, that this was the behavior of a conventional army. I don't think the Israeli were worse than any other modern armies in the second half of the 20th century, but I'm saying that they were no better. And indeed, as one can see, the agenda of the current peace process, it's very clear that the Palestinian claims or the Palestinian version of what had happened in 1948, for instance, the claim that the Israelis had expelled the Palestinians, of course, has a lot of relevance and is relevant to the nature of the solution for the problem and is the basic reason for the continuous Palestinian demand on the right of return, which for most of the Israelis is not acceptable. In fact, all the Israeli politicians and the Israeli parliament, in fact, passed a law about that. They claim that the right of return is like an act of suicide for the Israelis. So these are these are raw nerves. This is a very delicate subject, a very touchy subject, and I think most Israeli historians, until myself and others came around, found it very difficult to deal with.
Ilan Pepe is a senior lecturer at the Department of Political Science at Haifa University. On the line with us also is Meir Pael, who is a former Knesset member and a former military officer. Do you share Professor Pape's view of what happened with the establishment of Israel?
I'll start with the Palestinian refugees, okay?
Good.
The right of return. You know, basically, the Palestinian refugee problem gradually was created in 1948 during the Israeli War of Independence. This war was initiated by the Arab National Movement, by the total overall Arab National Movement and the specific Palestinian National Movement. Their intention was to occupy the whole of Palestine and eliminate totally Zionism and turn Palestine into an Arab entity, either an independent Palestinian state or some kind of a Palestinian state on both sides of the Jordan, with King Abdullah the king of both sides. So this was their intention. Whatever a Jewish settlement the Arab army succeeded to occupy, the Jews there were driven out, either as refugees towards the Jewish holdings, or they were taken prisoners. No Jewish settlements in the land of Israel, in the Holy Land, which happened to be occupied or conquered by any Arab entity, was given the right to stay. They were driven out. So the intention of the Arab National Movement was to eliminate Zionism totally. They didn't succeed. And one of the symptoms of their failure was that almost half of the Palestinian people found themselves refugees. Out of these people, about 60% just fled, and the others were driven out. So the Arab or the Palestinian refugees problem, or how would we say, disaster, was caused in those days by the Arab initiative and not by the Zionist initiative. So one cannot come now and behave some kind of a, how would we say, in Yiddish we say tzaddik, some kind of a pious people. You know, they drove us out. The initiation of this war was the initiative of the Arab national movement and the Palestinian national movement. They didn't succeed, so they must pay for their, how would we say, they should be, I would say, punished, or they should pay for their intention in 1948, like what the Soviet made with the Germans. They drove from Eastern Europe to Central Europe in between 9 million and 12 million Germans. And no one is even trying to criticize the Soviets, because everyone knows what was the intention of the German Nazi government in those days. So the issue of trying to push into Israel these 3-4 million refugees, just claiming or playing judicious, claiming, you know, they must go home, it's nonsense. It's total nonsense for two reasons. First, they are to be blamed for the initiation of the 48 war. We call it the War of Independence. If the Arabs wouldn't have started the war, there was no war. And we would have accepted what the United Nations General Assembly resolution of November the 29th was, and the Holy Land would have been partitioned between a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. They didn't accept it. There is a second reason. We have now in Israel the population of about 5 million people, out of which 4 million, I think 6 million people, about 4 million are Jews and 1 million are Palestinians. They are Israeli citizens. If we would agree to accept into Israel another 3 million, it is the end of the Jewish state named Israel. It would be a binational state, which is, from the point of view of the Zionist standpoint, it can be accepted. And most Arabs know it, and as far as I know the PLO attitude, I spoke with them, they speak about a right of return just only to their own Palestinian state, which would be established, and I think we should support them, in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as an independent Palestinian state. I agree that their government should be in Eastern Jerusalem, and whatever they would decide to do with the Palestinian refugees, it's their right to do. They would have their parliament, they would have their government. They may accept the idea to give whoever a Palestinian refugee a right of return to the Palestinian state, which is okay from my point of view.
Professor Pape.
I was very intrigued when Dr. Pail mentioned that by a national state is against the nature and concept of Zionism. And in fact, this is the ultimate proof to the fact that the Zionist leadership in 48 initiated the expulsion and the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. Because according to the United Nations partition plan, almost half of the population in the prospective Jewish state was supposed to be Palestinian. And indeed, although the Zionist leadership accepted the United Nations partition plan, it could not accept for long a state which had such a high percentage of Palestinians. And therefore, it initiated the expulsions, regardless of the question who started the war. And in fact, many
why
of
regardless?
You,
why
no, no,
regardless?
I didn't
this
interrupt.
Is the point.
No. I didn't interrupt you. Please don't interrupt me. Please let me finish.
Why won't you?
No. Please. I'm not going to answer you. I want to finish my point. And secondly, no. Please let me finish my point. The many of the expulsions took place during a situation of no war, when the war ended. In fact, the Israelis continued expelling Palestinians until 1954. So I think that I wouldn't doubt, and I don't really know who can doubt, that there were plans on the Arab side and on the Palestinian side to try and defeat the Jewish state. Nobody denies that.
What would have happened had the Arab armies won? We don't know. We can guess. But what we do know is what happened after the Jewish army won the war. And what happened after the Jewish army won the war was an ethnic cleansing operation to depopulate, to de-Arabize the Jewish state. And this continued, by the way, in a very slow measured, slow transfer measures, ever since 1948. So this is one point. This has very little relevance to the question who started the war and who didn't start the war.
What evidence do you have of the ethnic cleansing, Professor Pape?
The ethnic cleansing, I think that there are two kinds of evidence which are very important for the work of the historian. One is the IDF archives. But, of course, the IDF archives are blurred and are not very clear on it, and you need a very sharp eye to find out how a command, which was quite obscure and not very clear-cut, produced an atmosphere which encouraged Israeli commanders and soldiers, wherever they were, to clean the country and expel its indigenous population. But if you add to that obscure archival material the oral histories, that is, you go to the you interview people who participated on both sides, you fill the gaps which exist in the archival material, and you could quite easily reconstruct a picture which reminds us of acts of ethnic cleansing in other places in the world. If I may, I just want to make another point.
I just want to bring Dr. Meir Payel in for a minute, because I'm afraid we're going to lose him. I know that he has to go. Professor of Military History, you have said you spoke on Israeli radio in March saying that the IDF should reoccupy the territories, clear out the resistance infrastructure over the course of a number of days, and then declare its interest in the establishment of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. How do you justify the IDF moving into the territories and reoccupying them? Professor Payel. Well, he has left. We'll go to a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Professor Pape, and hopefully we could get Professor Payel back. You're listening to Democracy Now!
When one man's got millions and another ain't got a dime, that's when law and order's just another name for crime. Here's one simple fact of life that must be understood. The rich are rich because the poor are poor. And brother, that is good. That ain't good. That ain't good. That ain't no good. That ain't good for me and my brothers and sisters. And brother, that ain't no good. That ain't good. That ain't good. You two-faced politicians who saying we shall overcome, but support the institutions I need liberation from. You and me, ain't we, my friends? Let this be understood. The rich are rich because the poor are poor. And brother, that ain't good, that ain't good. That ain't good, that ain't no good. That ain't good for me and my brothers and sisters. And brother, that ain't no good. That ain't good. That ain't good.
The great Matt Jones, one of the founders of the Freedom Singers, joining us in our Firehouse studio here at Downtown Community Television, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. We are joined by Professor Ilan Pape, who teaches political science at Haifa University and author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Unfortunately, Professor Meir Payel had to go, professor of military history. But your response to what he said, Professor Pape, about this issue of reinvading the West Bank and then declaring that there should be a Palestinian state.
Yes, I'm afraid that this is not very far from the program of Sharon with which we have started our conversation. The idea that Israel, by military force, can impose its will on the future map is not new and is quite horrendous, actually. It means that Israel would go in kill whoever it doesn't like, leave all the political leaders with which are collaborators, and restructure a map which would include a very small Palestinian entity without sovereignty and without proper statehood. This is actually planting the roots or the seeds of the next three or four violent cycles of the conflict in the many, many years to come. This is not only a bad solution, it's a recipe for even more bloodshed and violence in the coming decades. So I really think that one should stop even suggesting such plans. And the only alternative and the only way to peace is now to negotiate over all the comprehensive issues which we had mentioned. And many of them emanate from the history, both of the 1948 and the 1967 wars. And without such a comprehensive approach, I'm afraid on both sides there will be many more victims in the years to come.
Professor Norman Finkelstein also joins us. He's a lecturer at DePaul University in Chicago and has written a number of books on the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. We talk about history, and we also want to talk about the settlements and what role they play in all of this. Professor Finkelstein.
Well, basically, I think, first of all, let me say hello to Ilan Pepe. We correspond occasionally, but rarely see each other or speak. Basically, I think the picture is this. The settlements played the same role after June 1967 as they played in the original Zionist settlement of Palestine at the turn of the century. I'm going to just very briefly try to summarize the picture and then explain the settlements as I see it. When the Zionist movement first came to Palestine at the turn of the century, its main problem was that Palestine was already occupied. There was an indigenous population. And the question was, how do you create a Jewish state in an area which is predominantly non-Jewish? And from probably around the early 1930s, the Zionist movement, the consensus within the mainstream was that the only way you can do it was through what was called at the time transfer, kind of euphemism. Sometimes they use the word force transfer, but basically a euphemism for what we would now call ethnic cleansing. And the question then was, well, how do you bring it about? How do you achieve it? And Ben-Gurion, who was the leader of the Zionist movement within Palestine at the time, he said it was a question of timing, that you needed what he called revolutionary times, which allow for radical changes to occur, unlike in normal times. And basically in 1948, those revolutionary times, to use Ben-Gurion's expression, those revolutionary times occurred in the course of the first Arab-Israeli war, and the goal of transfer, or what, as I say, we'd now call ethnic cleansing, was accomplished. And that's where matters basically stood between 1948 and 67. A Jewish state was created, the indigenous population was expelled, and the Zionist aim was achieved. And come 1967, the aim was completed. In 48, Jewish state was established in about 77% of Palestine. And come 1967, the goal is now completed with the conquest of all of Palestine by the Zionist movement, now Israel. But the problem again arose, just as in the turn of the century they wanted to create a Jewish state in an area which was predominantly non-Jewish. Come 1967, they want to extend the borders of the Jewish state, but again in an area which is predominantly non-Jewish, which is Christian and Muslim Arab. And now the same dilemma arises. How do you achieve this goal? Well, one crucial change has occurred in the interim. That is, after the Nazi experiments with demographic engineering during World War II, the international community in the Geneva Conventions prohibited population transfers. And so what the Zionists aimed in the 1930s, namely to transfer the population, which was, to be perfectly honest, was actually considered pretty legitimate in the international community, by the late 1960s, it was no longer considered legitimate, as I said, in the aftermath of World War II and the Geneva Conventions. So now the question is, well, if you can't expel the population, what can you do in order to annex the land? And the goal basically was, a very good Israeli historian, Benny Morris, he once said that the Zionist movement basically had two choices to achieve its aim. One was transfer, he said, and the other he called the way of South Africa, namely to create what he called a settler minority lording it over the indigenous minority, a settler minority lording it over the indigenous majority. And after the June 1967 war, with the transfer option no longer available, it wasn't surprising, exactly as Morris suggested, that they would switch now to the South African Bantustan model. And the South African Bantustan model is basically to fragment the territory of the indigenous population, have it surrounded by, crisscrossed with Jewish settlements, and effectively prevent any kind of meaningful sovereignty by the indigenous population on the one hand, and allow for the effective annexation of the territory worth keeping by the settler minority, in this case the State of Israel. And basically what the settlements do is they allow for two things: the effective annexation of the territory worth keeping by Israel on the one hand, and the prevention of any kind of meaningful sovereignty by the indigenous population on the other hand. It's no accident, for example, that the settlements are built precisely in those areas of the West Bank which allow for the Israeli confiscation of Palestinian water resources. If you want a map,
we have just a minute.
Yeah, if you want a map of the settlements, all you need is a hydraulic map of the West Bank, because the settlements are built in order to allow for the annexation. So I think that's basically the picture. The picture is the settlements allow for the annexation of the territory, which is the maximum option the Israelis can hope for in the absence of the transfer option.
Professor Pape, I want to ask your views in Israel, and then ask Norm Finkelstein this last minute that we have. How are they received? You're a professor at Haifa University. As you talk about the issue of of ethnic cleansing of 1967, the war not being about the Arab countries wanting to destroy Israel.
Well, I think that in the last 12 months or so, there is less tolerant than there used to be, let's say, in the mid of the 1990s. And I'm quite isolated, and I have problems with promotion and publication and so on. This is the negative side of the story, and if I may make public appearances on TV or radio, then, of course, I get also hate calls and hate speech and hate letters. The positive side of the story is that I'm still very popular among the students, who are more open-minded than my colleagues. This leaves me optimistic about the future. I think among the younger generation, there's a willingness to hear a different narrative, a different version of history from the one they used to, because what they see on the ground and the realities they see around them validates, legitimizes in their eyes claims of a different story from the one they knew about 1948. But I don't want to paint a picture which shows a massive movement behind me. But I'm just saying that if there is a chance to convince Israelis that they have to face boldly the past and the unpleasant chapters in the past in which they played the role of the victimizer and in a way also the criminal or the villain, it is with the younger generation and not with my colleagues or the academic milieu.
Well, Professor Pape and Professor Norman Finkelstein, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Haifa and from Chicago. That does it for the show. You can get contact information at mail@democracynow.org. democracynow.org is our website. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Oh, freedom over me. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave. I gotta fight for my right to be free. Guide my feet while I run this race. Guide my feet. while I run this race, guide my feet. While I run this race, 'cause I don't want to run this race in vain, race in vain. Guide